I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down on the wheel line, right, fighting and talking down me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. If you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking side of me, running down the real life, I'm fighting in a fought fight. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you run down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. They're going to play a good part of the meeting that took place, one of the three meetings, actually, we had in Vancouver this weekend in our Cross Canada speaking tour with Monica Schaefer. She's now delivered eight speeches in... excuse me. She's spoken in four cities in Ontario and in four cities in Western Canada. So she's delivered 11 speeches in eight different cities. And that's really quite impressive. We were in Vancouver. We were there on the weekend. We were at a meeting for Truth and Justice for Germans, a meeting for the Canadian Association for Free Expression, and a meeting at Brian Rue's place. Monica spoke in all three. I'm going to play a good deal of her Saturday speech, and this speech, of course, dealt with her becoming a political prisoner this past January 3rd in Germany, and she finally got out after serving 10 months in very late October. And this is Monica Schaefer at the meeting in Vancouver this weekend. I'm not quite sure why we are having a problem with this. Let's see. Well, that's not what we want to hear. Let's try it again. Not surprisingly, it tells us that this video can't be played here, but you can still watch on YouTube. The following content has been identified by the YouTube community as as inappropriate for some audiences. I still want to hear it. Unbowed and Proud, Monica Schaefer.
Welcome, Monica. This is January 26, 2019. Monica's in Vancouver. You've been here before, so tell us about your experience and your trip so far. You've been all already across Canada.
This is talk number 8 in the 8 cities. And across Canada, you can tour. And it's going marvelously. Thank you, Ryan.
Great to have you here. Fill the plate.
So when I was young, I never dreamed that one day I might find myself turning into a perfect Christian. That was the furthest thing from my mind. I remember reading some books as a young person about political prisoners who came from far away. Maybe they were a political prisoner in the Soviet Union, Alpha-Blader, or somewhere else. And I just thought political prisoners are only in very far away places, in very evil dictatorships, and it's just, you know, very far away from our existence. We grew up with this notion that we have freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and we have government for the people, by the people, of the people. This is a mantra that was basically pumped into our heads. And so therefore we also believed everything we were taught, because if we have freedom of speech and we have freedom of the press, then everything is free and great, you know, and we live in a great country. That's the other thing we were always told, we live in the greatest country on earth. Then why would we not believe what we're being told in the press or in the schools or by the teachers or the professors or anybody else? And so that's the background of how I grew up. Political prisoner, what does that mean? Somebody who's in prison simply for speaking things, just peaceful expression of views, conclusions, thoughts, beliefs, whatever the case may be. I guess there are some things that we're not allowed to talk about, and I sure found that out. But it doesn't mean we're not talking about it. Yeah. They think that they can silence us by imprisoning us. All they are doing is shining a light on the fact that there is a problem with their story that they need to silence by force people who are dissident views. And they shine a light on that, and they magnify that, and they did prove to us over and over again in the trial, and I'll tell the story of what happened, you know, when I was arrested and imprisoned, and sort of give you a bit of a rundown of those 10 months in Germany. Yes. So, January 3rd. I had gone to Germany for just a holiday, Christmas time, 2017. I was going to be away for 1 month, middle of December till middle of January, so it's 2017-18, just over a year ago, to visit my brother, who lives in Germany, Alfred Schaefer. And it turns out that on January 3rd, there was to be a trial. Another court date for Sylvia Scholz. I think probably many of you have heard her name. I'll just give you a brief summary of her story. Sylvia Scholz was a lawyer. She had done her job too well in defending Ernst Zundel years ago in his German trial. I'm not sure what year that was. I think maybe 10 years ago or so. And she was basically hauled out of the court and imprisoned for over 3 years because she was presenting evidence that was, the judge had said, stop, that's illegal, and she didn't stop. And she, only speaking, it's not like she did something violent in the court and that they had to, you know, calm her down, no. Anyway, so she had already been in prison years ago, and of course, with political prisoners, it is beach in Switzerland, and it was at a freedom of speech type of a conference, is my understanding of it. She did not mention the word Holocaust once in her speech, and yet, when she got back to Germany, she was charged for that speech, apparently in the context of what she spoke. You know, she spoke forbidden things. This law, paragraph 130, which exists in Germany, it's a very nebulous law. You cannot really grasp it. It's not concrete. It doesn't tell you what you can and can't do. It's very jelly-like, sort of slithers away out of your fingers when you try to grasp it. And a law has to be that way if it is designed to protect a lie or to, you know, they can then interpret it whichever way they need to. Because theoretically, they should be charging some of the mainstream magazines and television people, or even the Yad Vashem Museum in Israel, because all of these sources have said things which don't agree with the sort of the usual narrative. Their numbers of how many people were killed in so-called, you know, death camps change drastically. Their stories of how the people were killed change drastically in mainstream sources. But those people, they just go on their merry way. If we point out outside of Munich. They had to, you know, go go through the motions of taking me before a judge the next day. Within 24 hours, they have to see what they do with me. Well, flight risk for me, so it was easy enough for them to lock me up, put me in the jail, Stadelheim. And so then I began my new location, but I never knew what was going to happen. The whole time I was there, for nearly 10 months, I didn't know how long was I going to be there, what's going to happen. It took almost 4 months before they served me with the formal charges. So April 20th is the date I received the charges. And then the trial started 1 day short of the 6 month deadline that they can keep somebody before their trial starts. Now, sounds like a sort of hard line, but they can extend that easily. They would have done that. There were other prisoners there that I met who had been there much longer than I was, without trial, without facing court, which is interesting. You know, they pretend they have some rules, but they get around these things quite easily. I have lots and lots of prison stories. It was just a very interesting experience. But I thought I should probably focus mainly on the trial, which was also a hugely interesting experience. But I also then would like to, you know, get let you guide me with questions and what you're interested in. But perhaps I'll just, you know, talk for a while first and then play some music in between and then be guided by your questions. And I'll give you a little bit of a picture of what happened at this trial. I would say that the trial was a splendid example of verdict first, and then we'll do the show trial, you know, something that they have to do by law. It was very clear every step of the way that we were their enemy, and the judges were forming a team with the prosecutor. So it's like team prosecutor with the judges and then us. I lost count of the number of times that our lawyers submitted motion to recuse these judges on grounds of bias or obvious conflict of interest. That's what I'm looking for. And when our lawyers do that, they need very concrete reasons. They can't just decide, gee, I don't like the way this is going, and we're going to try to recuse these judges, get rid of them, and start over. No, no, because that would then jeopardize their own careers. These things are very serious matters. So they would have to, you know, write out their grounds for wanting to recuse the judges. And then it would go before, that would be submitted to another panel of judges, three of them. But every time our judges came back, like Jack in the Box, they were always back. They never were recused. And I lost count of the number of times this happened, and I will try to give you a couple of examples why or how they demonstrated their bias and that they should have been thrown out, because it was very clear to us that they were not neutral. Not neutral. Not at all. Okay. But before I do go too much into the story of the trial, I'll talk a little bit about the prison time, because there's 6 months that just went by and I didn't really tell you anything about it. Something that really left a lasting impression for me was how time can change. I would say the first month felt like a lifetime, and you know, every day very slow, because the first couple of weeks, 2.5 weeks, I didn't have any contact with the outside world. No phone call, no visit, no nothing, no information. It was just like this dark hole I fell into. And then, of course, my mind, I'm thinking about how are my things going to be, my affairs at home, how is it all going to be taken care of? Am I going to end up losing my home? Am I going to end up, you know, just all these things that had to happen. I mean, I had students that were expecting me back at a certain date, and I thought, how am I going to communicate with them? I don't want them to show up and I'm just not there. They need to be taught. Somebody needs to talk to them. My car was at the airport in Edmonton. I mean, just all these details that I couldn't communicate with anybody. And then also, I mean, to say nothing of the fact that, I wonder what's going to happen with me. This is a shock. Of course it's a shock. It was just surreal, actually. I mean, am I living this? Am I really living this? You know, you have to sort of pinch yourself. And actually, I'll go to the first night in jail. Actually, it was before I got to the Stadelheim prison in that police station. It was this cavernous, high-ceilinged, cavernous cell. And halfway down the cavernous cell, there were bars. On the other side of these bars was the sink. So a water source was out of reach for me. I just had this bunk, and they'd give me two horse blankets, the rough wool blankets. One of them I used as a pillow, and the other one I used on top of me. And then there was a toilet bowl there. They had forgotten to put the toilet paper on this side of the bars. It was on the other side, but my mouth was very dry. They showed me there was a bell there that I could ring in an emergency. And, well, when you're thirsty, I figured, yeah, I can press that bell. So I did, and, you know, they come with the tiniest little paper cup and fill the water and hand it through the bars and, more, please, you know.
Learned that
oh yeah, they're right after all, and I was wrong. That's not what I learned. I learned many things there. And I grew as a person. I think it was something that I would not want to throw away that part of my life now and say, gee, I wish that didn't happen. But again, how does one say that without this notion of, oh, you wanted to go to jail? Of course not. It was this shock. They rip you out of your life. Basically, they try to destroy your life. I mean, they had already tried that before with all the ritual defamation I was facing in Casper. But anyway, now it's all part of my life's experience. And it was very, very interesting. Yeah, and then time started. I talked about time expanding and shrinking. This is this really big lasting impression. We all have experienced times in our life when things are going really fast, and then other times when time is dragging, depending on what we're doing in life, or if we're waiting for something, or if we're, you know, having an exciting time or not an exciting time. Time goes this way and this way, even though our clocks are ticking away very precisely and very steadily, and our calendars, you know, it's all very steady. However, our perceptions of time, now this has never been more pronounced than this time in jail. So at first, time went extremely slow, and I reread my journal that I kept just the other day before starting this speaking tour, and things that all happened in the first month, when I reread this now, now that I'm out, I couldn't believe it. I thought, really, that all happened in the first month? Like, it was just so much that it happened in the first month in terms of the impressions and, you know, that I was writing all these things down. Later, I would have thought, no, that happened much later. No. And then, as time, it started to speed up. And it sped up. And by the end, it's like, time is going like this. And how that really was marked for me, what made it, you know, what marked the time was things like laundry exchange. Well, we have laundry exchange 3 times a week for little stuff like socks and underwear, and then once a week for the bigger stuff like the shirts and the sweatshirt and, you know, that thing. But then every second week there would be the bedding exchange. Okay, so in the beginning, 2 weeks is an eternity in jail, and it's a long time ago that you pulled your sheets and did the exchange of the bedding. Then after a few months, it was like, oh, bedding exchange? Really? I thought we just had that like a few days ago. Oh, maybe it was last week. Oh, it was 2 weeks ago? Couldn't be. So this is how I was marking time. And then there'd be another bedding exchange, and that means a month just went by. And this was actually kind of frightening to me, because I did not want to wish my life away when time was going so fast. Now, you might think, gee, that's good if time goes fast in prison because you want to get out of prison. But all the time, I didn't know when I was getting out. So it was very strange. You know, most prisoners, if they know their end date, of course they would be so happy if time just streams by like that. But it could be that time went so fast for me because I was very engaged the whole time. I kept myself occupied and busy. I had my violin after March 22nd, so almost 3 months in, and that was wonderful. It just really made a difference for me for life in prison, that I actually had my own violin and could practice daily, and I played in church on Sundays at prison church, of course. It's not like we went out to a church downtown Munich. So that was wonderful. It opened a lot of doors for me. I was able to help in terms of just sharing a little bit with other prisoners through that, they enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, so it was a gift both ways. There were some interesting and funny stories with the violin too. When I first got it, I was so excited that the first time that I played it, I noticed when I looked out the window, and I have to describe, everybody's facing into a courtyard, so all the prisoners' cells are facing inwards, and so theoretically, you know, we could wave at each other, and theoretically we could talk, but that was strictly forbidden to talk between window to window, and if you got caught, there would be, you know, disciplinary actions and all that. But anyway, I just noticed when I looked out the window when I was playing that all these heads were coming to their windows. I noticed it, like, oh, people are coming to the windows. So they were hearing it through the cracked, slightly open window. So I kind of got excited about that, and I thought, oh, I'll just open the window wide and play into the courtyard. And the reaction, the response was just like, everybody was just yeah, you know, like just clapping and having a great time. But one woman was, obviously she didn't like violin, maybe once upon a time she'd been traumatized by somebody with a violin or something, but she just screamed, shut your window if you're going to practice that thing. And I didn't say anything, but all the other women just said, no, you shut your window. And then I just stopped playing that day, but the next few days I opened the window a crack at the end of my hour of practice, and we had a little, you know, 5 or 10 minute party, but through the courtyard, not together, we're all in our cells, you know, but just everybody's jovial and loving it. But that all came to an end when a guard caught us, and my cell was stormed by 3 very intimidating looking guards. They put on their intimidating stance, you know, with their, like, they, yeah, and they come in and they lock my windows, and I had to go visit the jail boss after that. And anyway, I was careful after that, but because I didn't want them to take the violin away, there was always that threat hanging over my head. But after about a month, I started to crack the window a little bit, but nobody was doing the mistake of wild applause, and that was, you know, a little bit too much. I guess they don't like it when we were having fun. They get a little nervous in jail. It's true. When we were having a jovial time and too much sort of, you know, they would get nervous. I don't know why. It seems strange. You'd think they'd be happy that we're having a good time. You know? Okay, so it was just one little story, I guess, around the music. But I did have people telling me in courtyard hour that they could close their eyes and forget where they were for a few minutes. So that was very rewarding for me. It was nice to hear that kind of feedback. So let's go into the trial. Well, July 2nd, it began. That first week, we had 4 days in a row, and I would say that first week was absolutely wild. It was, a bit of a gong show. And Alfred did get thrown in jail that night. For one night, he got out the next day on bail because of his contempt of court, basically. He did not respect the judge, did not stand up for the judge when the judge entered, because he said he's not a judge, this is an inquisition. He also called it a Muppet show, and the judge really didn't like that. Very big insult. And then, the first problem I had was that I must have had some kind of a physical reaction, like I don't know if it was adrenaline or what, because when I was brought in, handcuffed, of course, I was the prisoner being led in, an unexpected thing happened. You know, on television, when you watch the news and there's a throng of reporters and cameras and all this stuff and just surrounding somebody, whether it's a villain or a star or whoever, you know, this happened to me when I entered, and it was so unexpected. All of a sudden, there's this sea of cameras and flash, 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 and Alfred jumps out of his chair and gives me a big hug, and then he starts talking to them and talking to the whole court how we're winning this and the lies are busting apart, and he's basically just totally jubilantly saying all these things and being very confident and courageous, I would say, because he's just saying, you know, the lies are over and, you know, yeah, we're winning this. And anyway, I couldn't move my mouth. And so once they had all left, because they weren't in the court for the proceedings, the camera people, they all left, they were gone, but I was led to my chair, and I couldn't move my mouth. It was like so dry, I think from this reaction of like surprise and a little bit of nervousness. I just spent 6 months in jail. This is the first court day, of course, you know, you get a little bit nervous, like other prisoners, they went through this, you know, even the day before court, my goodness, people were always a bit nervous, and I didn't know what would happen. So I was asking for water, and the judge says, no water in court, if you want water. I said, I couldn't move my mouth, actually, I couldn't talk. I mean, I'm telling my lawyer this, like, tongue was stuck. So then he said, no, if you want water, we need to recess. So Alfred immediately just said, oh, I need water, so we recess. I mean, it was like this total gong show, in and out, be led out and back in, and Then the microphone system. We had these beautiful microphones in front of each of us. You know, our lawyers, we, the judges, and the prosecutor. Everybody has a nice microphone in front of them. So we're sitting here, me, my lawyer, Alfred's lawyer, Alfred, then there's judges over there, and there's four of them. Two are professional judges, and two are what they call shuffen, which is a lay judge. So they don't have jury systems over there. They have these lay judges. They're supposed to have equal voice. But I think the main, you know, the main judge has a lot of influence there. And then on the other side of us would be the prosecutor, and then over here would be the press, and behind them would be the public gallery. So things are happening, and the public, they're kind of piping up that we can't hear. And we're also asking, why can't we have the microphones on? And the judge is just dismissive of that. We don't need the microphone. We can hear each other good enough, but the public is, everyone's like, we can't hear. Louder, please. We can't hear. Finally, midway through that day, I just stood up out of my chair. I didn't wait for an invitation to talk. I said, either this is a public trial or this is not a public trial. If the public is here and they cannot hear, and the judge does not care that they cannot hear, then what Alfred is describing this court as is true. It's a show. They are there for decoration. This is not a public trial. So either it's a public trial or it's not a public trial. You know, it's like a secret trial. The judge did not care about that. This did not impress him, this argument. Still wouldn't budge. I said a few more things. Just trying to repeat that message, be diplomatic, but strong, firm. I spoke in a very loud voice to make sure everybody could hear me. And finally, in exasperation, because he was not going to give, why, I do not know to this day. Finally, I just muttered, without a forethought, without a plan, I muttered, I can't hear that well anymore. And it wasn't even really true. Like, it just came out. Somebody must have given me guidance from above to say that, because suddenly he said, oh, you can't hear? No, I can't hear. Okay, get the technician. Technician comes within a minute or two, the system is turned on. It was not a problem. I guess for the judge, it did not matter if the public could hear, but it was going a little too far if the defendant couldn't hear. Anyway, what can you say? There was that, here's a very important point to tell you about a German court. I looked around, and I'm looking for a recording device, and I'm looking for a court reporter, a stenographer, somebody who's typing away everything that's said. And I don't see it, but things are said, there's questions and answers, things are happening. But I'm thinking, where's the record keepers? I talked to my lawyer, whisper. Where is it being recorded? I don't see. No. Nothing is recorded in the German court.
Wow.
So combine that with, he doesn't care if the public hears. There's no recording. So it's not going to be on the record. There's not going to be a historical record, archival record. Also, if we want to appeal, which we are, by the way, then you can't have a transcript of everything that happens in court. I mean, wow, where does this lead you? This is worse than the Dark Ages, because I had somebody write to me, he had researched the trial of one of the witches, you know, in the dark, like when they were having witch burnings. And he said that in that case, there's transcript of everything that happened in court. I mean, these court cases were terrible. They were basically also verdict first and, it, you know, the show later. But at least they had a transcript. He could do the research on it. Now, I don't know if that was the same for all of those cases, but the one he was researching, there was the full transcript of everything that took place in court. So right now, in the year, well, that was 2018, there's no written transcript of all the things that happened in court. The only thing that would be on the record are submissions in writing. So what happens then, the motivation is there and the impetus is there that you have to write everything, prepare everything that you're going to read out in court. It's very strange. I mean, yeah. And then fast forward some days later, Sylvia Schultz stands up in the public gallery. She was there most of the time, not all the time. And there's an interesting reason. thrown in jail. She said, that's terror. She just said it fairly softly, but that reached the judge, and he said, jail, 2 days. Yeah, she was thrown in jail for 2 days. Another man was thrown in jail for 4 days at the end of that week for something he said to the prosecutor out in the lobby. Just said, shame on you. I hope you get to see the inside of the jail at some point in your life. And she told that and to the judge, and he gave him 4 days jail. It was a dangerous place for people. But anyway, I was just saying about Sylvia standing up and saying, they took away our writing materials. They took away our pens and paper and or pencils, anything we have. We cannot take notes. We cannot write. And the judge says, yeah, that's right. You're not allowed to write. You're not allowed to write. So no transcript. The public's not allowed to write. First, they didn't want to turn on the microphones until the defendant said she couldn't hear. Okay, our lawyers just jumped on that and threw the books at the judges and said, under law, such and such, paragraph such and such, that's against the law. Well, they had a recess for that, and I think it took till the next day. I have to check my diary to be sure about that, but they did determine, yes, you can have your writing material back, but you can't be like doing a transcript style writing. You can't write every word, just point form notes. Like they're dictating to the public now how they can write about this trial. So these are some of the aspects of how it is in a German court. I don't know if that's always the case or if it's just for political speech crimes, but I think it is. Like my lawyer said, no, that's how it is. It's not recorded in Germany in the court system. So if they want to do verdict first and then a show and they have all these different elements of it, I mean, yeah, they can get away with it. So that's what they're doing. Now, in the beginning, they scheduled 4 days for a trial. Then they scheduled seven. Then a whole bunch of more days came. It was, in the end, it was 20-day trial. Until like July 2nd it started, and then with all the different breaks, till October 26th. Why they wanted to get it done in order with just in 4 days, or how they thought this would happen, that's a better way of phrasing that, is that they just show the offending bits of the videos that there were charges against Alfred, there were charges against me, and in primarily Alfred's videos, he's done a lot of videos, that then they just said, oh, minute 37 in this video, and minute 12 in this video, or whatever. They just give these little segments, they give exact minutes and seconds this, till minute and seconds this. They would just show the offending bits, and then be done with it. And yep, you broke the law, this is the law, and let's throw you in jail and throw away the key, perhaps. But this was not acceptable, because if you take these things out of context, you might not, well, it's completely useless. Like, the whole idea is enlightenment, education, and put it into context, and then the judges or anybody in that room at the end could never say again, oh, we just didn't understand it. Like, it would be impossible to have sat through that court case from beginning to end, and then later when they're on the other side of the dock, which they will be one day, because this criminal regime is going to fall, it's going to bust apart, and then we'll find those people on the other side. They'll be in the dock, and then they can't say, we just didn't understand, we just didn't know these things were happening, right? Because, I mean, I think most of them know and understand. I think that the judge years ago in the Ernst Zundel case, the judge who declared at the end of that trial, it doesn't matter if the Holocaust happened or not. What matters is that in Germany, it's against the law to question it, and you broke the law. Wow. Bang, 5 years. I mean, that judge clearly, I think, was indicating that he knew. He knew the truth. He didn't say it in that many words, but even what he did say was probably quite risky for him to say that. Maybe he got a slap on his hands by other, his cohorts. But he did then jail Ernst Zundel for 5 years, the maximum penalty under that paragraph 130. So, in our case, the judge didn't say anything like that at all. anyway, I have to go back to, they wanted to show just the little bits, and how did Alfred achieve that they had to show all the videos. He simply did not answer the questions pertaining to where were you when you made this or released this into the internet? Where did you do this? Where, just getting at that technical aspect so that they could prove that he broke the law in Germany by putting out these offending videos into the internet. And Alfred simply didn't answer, but he did say, we have to see the whole video. We have to see the whole video in its entirety. We need the context. We have to see the whole video, all of them. Finally, the judge relented, and he said, yep, we'll see the whole video. And they had to be translated into German afterwards, not simultaneously, because you lose a lot. So we had translators. They did their homework. They would put it into German, and after the video would be shown, they would read out the translation in German, and then there'd be a question and answer, and anyone like a prosecutor could do question and answer. The judges could ask questions, and then Alfred did most of the talking when it was pertaining to his videos. The charges against me were mainly about the Sorry Mom video, but there were other charges too. It was very confusing if there were four charges against me or six charges against me. In some document it was six, in some document it was four. But I said, whether there's four or six million charges against me, makes no difference. The truth is the truth is the truth. And, you know, this is basically irrelevant. How many charges there are is not going to change, you know, the history or the facts. So that part didn't really bother me at all. Yes, so that was then over the next period of time what was going on in court. It was like going to the movies. There's a big screen over there and a big screen behind us, and we'd see these videos, and then, you know, they'd hear the translation and then question and answer. When I was on non-court days in the prison, I mean, I was just jubilant about how this was in court, and always looking forward to it. And once I knew what was happening, and I would say to my friends in prison, every single day they're proving to us how the truth lies on our side, and they're just supporting lies. And I knew that wasn't necessarily gonna be mean that they're gonna declare us innocent, because they have their law and it's to protect these lies, and they're in the system. They are serving the wrong master, these judges and prosecutors, and they were clearly showing us that they were all in one team there. But I was still jubilant, because I felt it's like I got more and more confirmation from them by their behavior that, yeah, they're supporting lies, they're protecting the lies. We are on the side of truth. Truth lies with us. How are they demonstrating that? Like earlier I told you, they many times our lawyers were trying to get rid of these judges because they were demonstrating their bias. So, for example, any witness that we wanted to have that would be in our favor, they were just simply denied. Somebody who could prove or to verify, like a historical expert, to verify that some of the quotes that we were using, that either in Alfred's videos or the things he was reading into the court record, motions for evidence and whatnot, that he wasn't just pulling these things out of a hat, that these things really were true quotes by these certain people. A lot of this was coming from Jewish sources. I mean, they do tell us what they want to do with us, and a lot of these things, or police records of some of the things going on in Germany right now. And they were always denied. Their witnesses were given plenty of time in court if it was going to be damning of us, but our witnesses not. And the methods that were used, I'll give you just an example. There was this is really important because you were a star, Brian, in the court in Germany. One of the charges against us was the three-way conference that we had. So Alfred Schaefer, Monica Schaefer, and Brian. And that was, of course, produced in Canada. So you didn't break any laws in Germany. This video, it was shared on somebody's Facebook page in Germany. So maybe for a few seconds or for a few minutes or for a few hours it was available in Germany before they jumped on it and censored it out of the airspace in Germany. That's why that one was one of the charges, because it had been shared on Facebook in Germany. And somehow they are accusing me of a crime because I was in collusion with this person who shared it on his Facebook. Now, how many times do people share things, and do they actually go to the source and ask for permission to share things? No, we share things all the time, and we don't go and ask the person, can I share this? Like, you share things if you like them, and then they continue on, but suddenly we're guilty of this. But it meant that it was something that was put out in a German space, you know, the World Wide Web in Germany. Suddenly we're guilty of something. Now, there was a witness that was supposed to testify on the technical aspects of how much, like, what was this actually on that Facebook? That was just their charge, but no, there was no proof of it. That guy, he was a police officer. He was off duty because of post-traumatic stress disorder, probably due to other cases that he had witnessed. It had nothing to do with our case, but he was the one who was supposed to he had checked out the technical aspects of whether that video was in Germany. And he was not at work. So, okay, our lawyers happen to know the law that you could be off work due to PTSD, but it doesn't mean you are exempted from appearing in court if you are subpoenaed to court, unless you're, like, really on your deathbed or something. The bar is much higher for whether you can just say you can't go to court. It's a much higher bar than if you're working. Okay, so then my lawyer asked for the record of the email chain, the communication chain, because the judge said, nope, not available, even after this was pointed out that there's a higher bar and he should still come to court. Not available. He sees the email chain, and the judge basically wrote something to the effect, to the psychologist who was giving this guy the, you know, the check mark that no, you don't have to go to court. Yeah, just give us a one or two liner that tells us that he's not going to be available at all, and then we'll be done with it. Basically wash our hands of it. Like, this is about how he worded it. It was extremely manipulative. It was kind of telling this psychologist, this is, you know, just give us a one or two liner and we'll be done with it. This matter will be done with. So that was clearly a very, very, if you're the psychologist and you're receiving this from the high court judge, give us a one or two line. I mean, that's basically telling her what to say. And she did. She basically made a one or two liner, a little short paragraph, says, yep, he's not going to be available now, nor in the near or distant future, forevermore, something like that. She basically gave him exactly what he wanted, and he had manipulated the situation. So another call for dismissal of the judges, but it didn't work. Another one was Gerd Ittner was supposed to be a witness. In the beginning, he was actually on the witness list. Then he was removed from the witness list. He was in jail, also in jail by this time. He was in Nuremberg, and he wrote a 26-page letter to the judge. That was all about our case. He was going to relieve us of some of our guilt, in quotation marks, me as well as Alfred, both of us. And he outlined this in his 26-page letter, and the judge, the time kept going, and by law, the judges are supposed to present all of these things to both sides. Like, the prosecutor is supposed to get a copy of any evidence that gets put in, as well as the defense lawyers. They're supposed to receive this, but they didn't hear anything from the judges. They didn't receive anything. Meanwhile, there's more and more court dates being set because this thing wasn't ending. And the judge then announces that we're now going to close the files. Like, evidence is that we're going to move forward. The files close. No more evidence will be submitted. And then Alfred's lawyer says, yeah, excuse me, we heard something about a letter. Oh, what letter? Yeah, something, or who? Ittner, Gerd Ittner. Okay, we saw a reaction. The male judge, he turned purple, as he was wont to do sometimes. And the female judge, she blanched, she turned white. They clearly had a physical reaction to this sudden exposure of their mistake, well, their purposeful mistake. They wanted this to just be under the carpet. They did not want this witness. It was an inconvenient witness for them. Oh, well, this was a Friday, and another reason for recusing the judges. Well, they called Ittner for the Monday, and they did. Okay. Another thing that happened, another reason for wanting to recuse him, and this goes back to this police judge, this police witness, or it may have been Ittner, because that whole thing is a bit of a long story. It didn't really work out because he was then thrown out. But my lawyer was wanting to have him anyway, have Ittner anyway, and make another request for this witness. The judge was basically dismissing him and said, I know that you can do that during the appeal. Pardon me, during the appeal? Like, that means he's got a verdict first. He's got the verdict already. We're not at the end of the trial. If there's an appeal, that means there's a guilty verdict. Like, so he just blew it again. When these answers came from the panel of three judges, each time that there was a motion to recuse these judges for bias and their non-neutrality, one of those times they must have really struggled, because they even said things like, well, yes, this was awkward, or this was, it was awkward wording, this kind of thing. But they always found a way to basically say, no, this is all fair and good, and we'll continue the trial and go on our merry way. They were not going to just throw it out and start over. So these are just some examples of how this went in this trial. And that's why how I feel they were demonstrating to us that truth was on our side. And they just did, this was a show. It was a show trial. It was Orwellian, Kafka, what can you say? There are many other aspects of it that would demonstrate that. But I'll just take a look at my notes and see if...
Dr. Schaefer, and I'm going to continue this later in the week. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
Firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the fiddle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever.